This week's near-complete shutdown of the internet in Egypt was unprecedented in the history of the web. While the internet is up and running again in the country, the lessons from that decision still remain unclear. And on today's Backstory segment, we will look at what the shutdown means for the internet service providers, human rights, and the future of online activism. And we're joined now by Andrew McLaughlin, former Deputy Chief Technology Officer in the Obama administration, and by Cynthia Wong, an attorney at the Center for Democracy and Technology. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Andrew, the internet has been disrupted or slowed down in other countries where there's been unrest, like Iran. What was so different about the Egyptian shutdown this week?
Well, there were two things that were, I think, notable about it. It is not the first time that a country has disconnected itself from the internet. There are cases in Myanmar and Nepal where, you know, all internet connectivity went down for a period of time. What's different about Egypt is that it's the first time that a modern economy that was very well connected decided to shut itself off from the internet. The second thing I think that's notable about it is that the particular technique that the Egyptians used showed a pretty high degree of sophistication about how to shut off your own country from the internet, but leave neighboring nations essentially undisturbed, to allow internet to continue to flow through your country, but to keep your own people isolated from that global network.
That's a kind of an unglobalization process.
Well, that's exactly right. And you know, one of the things that's so interesting about it is that up until last week, Egypt's internet had a reputation, and a rather unusual reputation in the Arab world, for being essentially uncensored. So outside of a handful of cases over the last decade, Egypt never exercised sort of content censorship. You could read, you could get access to websites that had the Danish Muhammad cartoons. You could get access to websites that included rumors about the president's health, stories about military involvement in torture, and so forth. They didn't use the tool of censorship. And one of the things that I think is very interesting about the lessons that the unfortunate lessons that repressive regimes and authoritarian regimes might take out of Egypt is that they messed up by not building a more pinpointed and sophisticated censorship infrastructure, and finding themselves left really with the choice of leave everything on or turn everything off when the protests started to swell in the streets.
I want to come back to this in a little while, but Cynthia, today the UK-based cellular provider Vodafone accused the government of Egypt of co-opting its network to send out pro-government text messages. Are we witnessing a wider information war now?
Well, I think that the notion that governments might co-opt general-purpose communications tools to promote their own viewpoints is actually not that new. Other countries have actually started to engage in this as well. But I think it shows you that the governments really do have a lot of leverage over these major telecom providers who often have physical infrastructure in the country and who often have employees on the ground itself, that it's very easy for the government to kind of take over these networks and force them to do what they want them to do.
Well, the technology companies went along with the government's demands regarding the internet and cellular service. Vodafone shut down the internet in compliance with Mubarak's demands. But we've seen similar things in this country, haven't we? Compliance to requests for secret wiretapping by the Bush administration, perhaps the Obama administration as well.
And it's often, as it is here in the Vodafone case, it's often hard to know what exactly governments are demanding of companies and how much these companies are actually pushing back against government requests. I mean, I think that at the very least, the government requests in Egypt to shut down the network or to send text messages shouldn't have been a surprise to any company that really pays attention to the politics of the region. And I think that the one difference, of course, in the U.S. is that we do have greater rule of law and greater due process concerns, but I think that these issues are certainly coming up all over the world.
Well, Andrew, how much can a company push back? Many of these companies are multinationals. I would assume it gives them some leeway. On the other hand, they want to be in as many different places as they can.
My view on that actually is that companies have a toolbox. They have a set of things that they can do when they find themselves confronting what they believe to be unjust or in extreme cases, even illegal demands by the government. And that toolbox includes things like, for example, insisting upon government decisions in writing. One of the things that repressive regimes like to do is to just pick up the phone and bark at the CEO of the local division and say, you have to go and do this, or we're going to start throwing your employees in jail. One of the things that companies can do is insist upon due process. Bureaucracies hate to put their names on decisions that might come back to haunt them later, and it can be a disincentive to go off and do that. In addition, they can use things like public pressure, in other words, disclosing the government's demands to the world, providing information about it, and so forth. Realistically, of course, they have to take account of the interests of their employees, and here the reputation and willingness of the regime to, you know, take the battle to individual employees that they might want to jail or imprison or do that to their family members and so forth is you know, a very real, you know, sort of dilemma that they've got to grapple with. And I think the moment to be grappling with that, as Cynthia alluded to, is before you go into the country rather than after you're already there with 5,000 employees and a nationwide service.
Cynthia, Evgeny Marzov was on the show recently to talk about a book he's written that suggests the web is a lot more useful to repressive governments than to democracy seekers. Do you see his point?
I do, and I think he does have a point to a certain extent. I mean, certainly tools like Twitter or Facebook, tools that are used by activists to organize, can also be used by governments to assert greater control as well. I mean, governments can use social networks to track down activists, to detain them, or to intimidate the family members of activists, et cetera. But at the same time, I think the real power of the social media actually lies in what happens before people take to the streets, and that these are really tools that enable ordinary citizens to talk to each other about issues of common concern, not just things like police brutality, but also things like the economy, food prices, job prospects, things that the Egyptian protesters themselves are really speaking out against. And it's really these tools that enable people to get access to independent media in places where traditional media is tightly controlled. And so it's really the power of these tools to enable civil society and average individuals to really form networks of common concern and to really organize efforts to promote reform.
New York Times reporter Karim Fahim was on this program earlier this week from Cairo talking about the demonstrators. And I want to play something that he had to say about the internet shutdown.
I spoke to several, I met, you know, several of the sort of internet generation activists in Tahrir Square today. And they said that, you know, once they had to leave their computers alone, once they were off Facebook, once they were off Twitter, you know, there was nothing to do but go to the streets. And that's what they did. And they sort of credit the decision to cut off the internet with enlarging the size of the crowds.
So in a sense, the shutdown may have backfired.
And I absolutely think that's right. I think that actually, you know, I think the Egyptian government will find that this has actually fueled protests even more. I mean, I think the government's thought process in taking this action was really to, number one, keep information about what's going on inside the country from reaching the international community, and number two, to also shut down the protesters' ability to organize. But I think one important thing to note in all of this is, number one, even though there was some core of the population that was willing to take to the streets, by shutting down the internet infrastructure itself, the government might have done much larger harm to the economy. And actually, one study has shown that, one quote has shown that possibly up to $18 million a day worth of harm to the Egyptian economy has been caused by the internet shutdown. And since the economy is such a key issue for many people in Egypt, it may have angered a much greater range of people than were originally protesting on the street.
The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development estimated that the five-day shutdown of the internet cost the Egyptian economy around $90 million.
Precisely, and that might actually be...
That's exacerbating one of the causes for the unrest in the first place.
Absolutely.
Can I offer a somewhat more cynical view of this, maybe?
Please. We love cynicism.
You know, So first of all, the economic harm is tremendous, and I think that 90 million figure is, you know, significantly underestimates the cost. As the OECD itself said in the paper, this is kind of a direct estimate of direct cost. But let me offer the following note, which is, one of the things that a cell phone network allows you to do in particular is to pinpoint the locations of individuals. And one of the things that we do know about the Egyptian security state is that they depended on surveillance, you know, much more heavily than other countries might depend on, say, censorship or blocking of content. And one of the more cynical takes here might be that that the Egyptian government was knew what they were doing. In other words, they wanted to shut down communications to try to, you know, take away organizing tools and the ability of people to send videos and photographs to the world of what's going on. As you said earlier, this turned out not to work. People went on the streets anyway. And then it can't be a coincidence that they turned the networks on at the exact same moment that they initiated the crackdown that we are now witnessing, this bloody, brutal, extraordinarily, I think, sort of disgraceful series of organized attacks on citizens, journalists, protesters, and others. And so it could well be that they have been preparing themselves for what they knew would be the inevitable crackdown. In other words, they might have said, let's let some protests happen, let's let people get their views out, and then we're going to get in, you know, back in control, restore order, reclaim the streets, reclaim Tahrir Square, and we're going to want to be able to use our cell phone networks to watch people's movements, to know who's where, to be able to find people when we want to arrest them, and so forth. And for activists that have just been casual users of cell phones, which is basically everybody but a very small group of people that have taken precautions, the government will know their phone numbers, they'll know how to reach them, they'll know how to look for them when they're out on the streets. And again, unless they're taking, you know, unusual precautions to cover their tracks in the data that they send and in the signals that their cell phones are sending out to the network all the time, those activists may be vulnerable.
Well, it cuts both ways, doesn't it, Cynthia? The global hacker network known as Anonymous took down Egyptian and Yemeni government websites today in solidarity with the protesters. But do you think that kind of action is useful, or is it counterproductive?
You know, I think it's kind of counterproductive. I mean, I don't think that countering, you know, a massive shutdown of communications ability on either side is really useful, and I don't think it's appropriate either as a response to a perceived or actual threat to national security. And just to build on something that Andrew just mentioned, I mean, I think one thing to note is that even though the Internet connections have been restored, there are some reports from within the country that specific websites are not consistently accessible, and those websites tend to be tools that activists are using, like Twitter and Facebook, et cetera. So it shows the government might be getting a little smarter in terms of knowing that they can shut down specific tools that activists are using without shutting down the entire network, which, again, has much wider consequences.
That's right. And intermittent access actually makes the cynic in me wonder if they aren't you know, doing things to the packet streams that are aimed at those websites. In other words, spying on them as best they can.
Now, how big a priority was Internet freedom internationally during your time in the Obama White House, Andrew? Is there anything our government can do other than to urge countries not to block Internet freedom?
Well, absolutely. You know, for example, one of the lessons coming out of Egypt is that the Egyptian government's ability to shut down the Internet was made possible by the fact that their Internet networks were so concentrated. There are only three mobile phone companies that have licenses to operate, and all Internet data was required to go through a single company in order to reach the outside world. There were a couple of exceptions to that. There were a couple of academic and research networks that coexisted, but for the vast majority of the Egyptian Internet, it went through Telecom Egypt. The lesson there, in one sense, is that diversity and decentralization in the network helps keep it up even when a government wants to shut it down. By the way, the same thing is true for when a hurricane hits or a flood happens or a tornado you know, destroys a central switching station for a communications company. Having diversity and decentralization and complexity in your network really helps. The implication for U.S. policy is that you know, when we're out there financing through our foreign aid programs or through our partnerships with the World Bank and IMF and so forth, when we're financing global communications infrastructure, we need to be attuned to insisting upon, you know, diverse paths and diverse connections in and out in ways that make it difficult for repressive governments to shut down or restrict or spy or whatever other nefarious things they may want to do.
Well, isn't China currently blocking information about Egypt online? It's kind of ironic, isn't it? We have run out of time. We didn't get a chance to talk about a proposal in Congress called a bill called Protecting Cyberspace as a National Asset Act. But my great thanks to both of you, Cynthia Wong and Andrew McLaughlin, for being on today's Backstory segment.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.